the first episode of Book Club Appetizer. I'm Abby.
And I'm Alana. We're two book addicts from readitforward.com. Sometimes we refer to ourselves as the bookie monsters, and not even ironically. We devour books on the regular.
It's true. Book Club Appetizer is the snackable podcast to kick off your book club meetings or to enhance your solo reading adventures. Our mission for this podcast is to spice up your basic book club by giving you ample food for thought as you make your way to your gathering or as you grab snacks and fill up your wine glass.
Every episode, we'll discuss the book we've been reading and bring the author into your living room to do a quick reading and answer our most pressing questions. Warning, there will be spoilers all up in this podcast. We're assuming you've read the book.
So, while you strategize your cheese selection,
don't forget the Gouda. Never forget the Gouda.
We'll talk a little bit about our first book club selection, The Czar of Love and Techno by Anthony Mara. His first book, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, was longlisted for a National Book Award, and Sarah Jessica Parker has raved about how much she loved it. So, I was eager to read this new book.
Before we bring Anthony on, let's talk through all the interwoven characters and interlocking plot lines in this narrative, just to serve as a refresher for everyone. I confess, there were a few moments when reading this book where I felt a little bit like I was playing a Russian time travel version of Where's Waldo? So, Abby, join me in a who's who.
Okay. Roman Markin is charged with painting government enemies out of paintings and painting officials into canvases where they didn't belong. He informs on his brother, who's killed as a result. Roman visits his brother's family to destroy all remaining images of his brother, but, as a tribute, paints him into the background of every painting he works on. He's caught with a photograph of a prima ballerina and declared a spy, and he's imprisoned and executed. Rough.
Vladimir is Roman's nephew, the boy who watches his father's face get removed from every photo. Vladimir becomes a petty criminal and actually spends time in the same prison where his uncle is executed. Sergei is Vladimir's son, who takes his dad to an exhibit of Roman's art, where Vladimir discovers his father's face in the background of every painting. It's very emotional.
Ruslan and Nadia work in an art museum in Grozny, and 50 years after Roman's death, Nadia's research questions the presence of the same face in all these paintings. Ruslan has a painting by a famous artist, Zakharov, that Roman once worked on. It's meaningful to Ruslan because it depicts the hillside where his wife and child were killed by a buried mine. And we definitely haven't seen the last of that hillside.
Galina is the granddaughter of the ballerina that got Roman in trouble. Galina is model pretty, but a terrible dancer. Her first love is a guy from school named Kolya, who is drafted to war and is killed by opposing forces on that same hillside. Galina marries a rich man and uses his money to buy the Zakharov painting from Ruslan, earning the couple enough money for Nadia's eye surgery. Yay, she can see.
Kolya is Galina's first love, who pines for her while at war. He returns to find her famous and engaged, and with nothing left to keep him at home, he decides to return to the front lines. Alexei is his brother and best friend, who gives him a mixtape to listen to in case of emergency. Years later, after Kolya's death, Alexei's given the painting of the hillside by Galina, so her husband doesn't get it in their divorce proceedings. Shrewd move. Alexei decides to journey to the hillside in the painting, where he meets Nadia and Ruslan, who are now married and living on the hillside. Ruslan finally gets his painting back.
There's so much more in this tangled web of time and love, betrayal, art, mystery. But that's for you to discuss with your group.
So now's your chance to refresh your wine glass, and when we come back, we'll have Anthony Mara with us in the studio.
Welcome to the show, Anthony. Abby and I loved this book, this collection, and we are so excited to have you here on the show. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
After I ask Anthony a couple of questions, he's kindly agreed to read us all a brief passage from the book, and that will be the end of our show. So without further ado, thus far in the podcast, we gave our best efforts to give our listeners the lay of the land of how all of the different characters in this book interact and interlock through, you know, relationships with one another, through objects, through places. It's a web. And we were wondering, what was your process for creating all of those different interactions? I'm sort of picturing a massive, like, string diagram, like, a la Beautiful Mind.
Exactly.
Is that what you had?
John Nash's apartment, yeah. It was actually a very gradual process. Originally, this short story collection was originally completed before Constellation. And I had 8 or 9 stories, and they were all individual. After Constellation came out, I really felt that that version of Czar just really didn't stand up to Constellation. It just didn't feel as robust, as complex, as fulfilling. And so I sort of set a challenge for myself to see if I could take these short stories, which weren't connected, and weave them together in order to create a book that was so cohesive that it would really feel like if you were to take any one story out, it would diminish the total. And I had this, I was sort of fixated on this idea of trying to write a novel that was composed of short stories rather than chapters, to have that really, you know, that beautiful feeling that you get towards the end of a novel where you begin to see how all of the pieces are coming together. And so it took about 2 years of rewriting these stories to try to find those points where characters would connect, where scenes or places or individuals could be collapsed. And I did not have, you know, colored string.
No,
on my
maybe
walls,
next time.
Yeah, but I did have a whole series of post-it notes. And in one column, it was the title of the story. In another column, it was the dates that the story covered. Because some of them, you know, the granddaughters, the second story covers about 70-odd years. The next column were the characters, the sort of major characters in each. And the final column had various objects that moved between the three. Mm-hmm. And so between particularly those last two columns, one with characters and one with objects, I could begin to sort of map out, at least on my bedroom wall, where...
It was on a wall, though, so
it was,
I was
on
close.
A wall.
Okay.
Yeah. And whenever I got bored, I would start to make little drawings and doodles and color in, you know, put polka dots on one and stars on another.
Wow,
so
okay.
It did look like I was losing my mind a little bit.
Another character, at least to Abby and me while we were doing this book, was Russia. The history just seems to play such an important role throughout the whole thing and provides that extra kind of connective thread. And I was just curious, you know, why Russia? And, you know, what sort of role do you think that the setting played in this book that could be different from other books?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been fascinated with Russian history for years now, and I suppose that one of the impulses that Czar grew out of was Constellation's mm-hmm. use of history, where mm-hmm. that looked at a very specific conflict in a very specific region and time and place. And with Czar, I kind of wanted to almost set up a backdrop behind that, so you could see how Constellation's story fit into this much, much broader historical continuum.
Yeah.
And I first became interested in Russia when I was in college. I had no, you know, desire to write about it at all, but I spent a semester, as you do when you're in college in Russia, and the sort of the swings, the extreme swings of history, of climate, of geography, the sheer scope on which life unfolds, mm-hmm. was mesmerizing. And the idea of just sort of pinning these very intimate stories about, you know, about families, about relationships on the tails of these great, you know, comets of history felt like...
Wow, very well put. Damn.
I'm not reading from notes.
I know, wow. This is all just from his brain, guys.
It just felt like... An irresistible challenge, I suppose.
Yeah, I know you mentioned objects before and how they also fit into your map and web of all these characters. Specific objects sort of seem to carry on and preserve memory of people after they'd gone, specifically art, so whether it was the painting or the music. And I was just wondering, what interests you in the legacy that we leave behind in objects, in addition to the legacy we leave behind in people and how they're different?
That's such a great question, and one that I'm not sure I have a great answer for, but I guess I would say that we all have keepsakes, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it seems like, when I was growing up, I had on the wall of my bedroom.
Everything's taking place on the wall.
Exactly, yeah. I had this old-fashioned telephone from my grandmother's house that, I'm not even sure what you call it, where the sort of the mouthpiece sticks out.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have the little cord that you bring up to your ear.
Mm-hmm. Like in Mary Poppins.
Exactly. It was a Mary Poppins phone. And, you know, somehow that evoked my grandmother and her era much more than any photograph of her did. And it was almost the things that we touch every day and that we, you know, hold in our hands almost leaves behind a greater residue of our personhood than does a photograph. And in both Czar and Constellation, I feel like objects play an enormously important role in terms of tying together these sprawling casts of characters, and how a single object such as this landscape painting in Czar plays, you know, an enormous role in the lives of so many different people
for different reasons,
who aren't really connected at all besides this painting. For a Russian whose brother was fighting in the Chechen conflict, and for a museum curator who was a victim of that conflict, they both prized this painting not for any monetary value, but rather for the pieces of their lives that they're trying to reclaim.
What is your object that you think you'll be leaving behind?
Probably my cell phone.
Oh, gosh. Well, your grandmother's phone and now your phone, so there's a nice continuity about that.
It's going right on the wall.
And one thing that I loved about this book, too, is that there is so much somber themes, but then there's these quick barbs of humor that pop in. I'm not sure if I'm quoting this exactly right, but hipsterdom's a tightrope strung over the canyon of douchebaggery.
Ain't that the truth?
I mean, that made me laugh out loud. And I'm just curious to know what you think the role of these humorous moments can play in these more really serious, sad, scary, vast moments in the book.
It's a great question. And one of the things that I feel like I'm not sure if proudest of is necessarily the right term, but that I'm most glad that I have as a writer is sort of access to both ends of the keyboard a little bit. Mm. I think that, you know, if we pick up a book set in Chechnya or set in Russia during some of these, you know, incredibly traumatic historical periods, we're expecting nothing but grim, bleak hellscapes. While, of course, you know, it has its fair share of,
yes,
of
that.
That's not how life is lived, I think. And when I traveled through Chechnya, one of the things that I was most amazed by was how sharp and you know, very, very dark, but incredibly sharp a sense of humor so many people I met had. And it would often be directed at exactly the thing you were most afraid of. It became a way of I think, both diffusing tension and of getting by, that I think a joke can be a very serious thing. I remember, I remember talking to this Chechen refugee named Ali, who's living in Massachusetts now, and he had experienced terrible torture in Chechnya at the hands of Russians, and he was describing it to me, and he had this beaming smile on his face, and he was making jokes about what he had gone through, and his wife was sitting next to him, and she was crying, and was asking why are you laughing at this? Yeah. And he just said, I have to.
Last but not least, if you were to pair your book with a beverage, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, and or a snack, what would you pair it with?
Yeah, I suppose I would say for alcoholic.
Let's start there.
Obviously, vodka would be a choice. I would say, though, that might, you know, if you're listening to this at the beginning of a book club, that might be hitting it
aggressively
a bit. Yeah. So George's is quite famous for its wines, mm-hmm. and they're also quite famous for their food. It's hugely popular in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So I would suggest maybe a nice red Georgian wine.
Great. So now, before we let you go, what passage did you select to read?
I'm going to read a passage from the title story, which is The Czar of Love and Techno. This describes the first date that a character named Kolya has with Galina. Galina told Kolya how much she hated the ballet, how terrible a dancer she was, and Kolya took her mittened hand in his own. He placed his right hand on the small of her back, pressing through the layers until she fell toward him, into him. He made finger holds in the valleys of her vertebrae. bump bada ba dump 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 dum, he trumpeted. It took her a moment to find in his atonal exhilaration the melody from the first march of the Nutcracker. By the time she did, she was already cantering, cratering the frost. What are you doing? She asked. Dance was supposed to be choreographed, rehearsed, and sterilized until its most trivial imperfections had been obliterated, along with any vestigial joy, and performed to silent, judgmental audiences. It wasn't spontaneous. It was never fun. This is a march, she stammered. You don't waltz to a march. I don't even know what a waltz is, Kolya breezed, breaking his a cappella rendition long enough to spin Galina in small circles, dipping her until her hair swished against the gravel. She wanted to weep, but she laughed. She joined in when he reprised the march. This feeling of rightness, of belonging-to-ness, it wasn't an idea or a word, but an absence of ideas and words, an airiness where blood and bone had been, right out to her weightless fingers, safely fastened within his, in case she floated away. The 12 apostles spouted golden pillars, shadows widened beyond wedges of electric light. Kolya entered the chorus with an orchestra of punch-drunk madmen living in him, belting the tune to the velvet yellow, to the misting lake, to the carcinogens no song could dislodge from his capillaries. And in this amphitheater of decimated industry, on this stage of ice and steel, he taught the granddaughter of a prima ballerina to dance.
Thanks for listening, readers. We have some more starter questions on our site, in addition to a link to the amazing Spotify mixtape that Anthony put together to go along with the book. We definitely suggest a mid-discussion dance party to mix things up.
If you liked this book and want to read more like it, we'll post a few recommendations on readitforward.com/podcast. We'll be producing a monthly show for fantastic books we think you should read with your book club.
And don't forget to follow us on Twitter @ReadItForward and tweet about books with us. Happy reading and cheers!